Hi, this is John Udall, and today's podcast is an interview with Kingsley Idehan, the CEO of OpenLink Software. OpenLink's Virtuoso is a kind of a universal database server with SQL XML capabilities, as well as web services enablement. The product has recently gone the open source route. We'll discuss the history, current status, and future of Virtuoso.
Let's step back to 2003. When you first sort of, brought some attention to Virtuoso, to where we are right now. Because at the time, I said to you that the focus we had was providing this transparent mechanism for integrating data and services. And, in the beginning, we had the virtual database, which was simply about doing that from the SQL perspective.
Right. So at that point, you were doing service enablement for not just your own database, but for any of the remote data sources that you could support.
SQL Store procedures, basically.
Right.
And then we extended that, which is where Mono came into play, beyond SQL Store procedures, so that if you had application logic that now sort of was encapsulated in a .NET assembly or in a Java class, by integrating or hosting those runtime environments, you were now able to integrate them into Virtuoso transparently, so that, again, when you were building these web services or simple SQL Store procedures or even simple queries, you had the ability to extend the database using these assemblies.
Yeah, and in a couple of ways, right? So the extension could be in terms of logic, but it could also be in terms of serialized object data.
All forms, including, in the simplest form, you would have what would appear to be a SQL function in a SQL statement. And the origins of that function would be in a .NET assembly, or a Java class, or a third-party web service that was WSDL accessible.
Yeah.
And, we did all of that, and as you know, because I remember one of the questions that you asked was, okay, what's the traction here? Who's doing what with this? And I think I said one of the biggest challenges I have with what we have done is that my biggest challenge is trying to get people to really understand why we have a single server product that implements such a broad array of protocols and APIs.
Mm-hmm.
Would people get lost in that, or would they see the relevance? Would they have a sense of alignment with our vision, which was that, what was a website then and earlier, so I'm talking about 2003 and earlier, would eventually evolve into a point of presence, Site, the visual interaction with the website will no longer be the defining mode of interaction. That the site was more akin to, an object relational database, in a sense.
Right, and some of us have always thought of it that way, but...
But the majority of people don't at all.
Yeah.
They have a site, you produce dynamic content, and that is about it.
Yeah.
And
I was thinking about, your fellow countryman, Dario Basanjo, just recently about the two webs, right? The sort of... HTTP interactive web and the HTTP services web.
Yes.
And it's funny. I mean, I for whatever reason, I've always seen things that way. I've always seen that there were these two sides of the same coin. But I think you're right. I think a lot of people, who might have taken a look at Virtuoso did get lost in the forest of APIs and protocols and formats.
What has happened, over the years is that a lot of people have looked at the product on a myriad of fronts and said, really innovative, pardon me. Really cool stuff, but we don't know where to start.
Right.
So the typical paradox for a Virtuoso evaluator is this. You go to the site, you download the product, you install it, and say, what do I do next, right?
Yeah.
What do I do next? Where do I start? Now, within the company, we spent so much time trying to make everything so simple that it became invisible. That fundamental starting point, what you once described as an activation threshold, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, you get the product. And it's like, you know, everyone's busy and time challenged, so you got about maybe 5 minutes, if you're lucky, to determine if you're going to engage this product any further.
Yeah. Well, I have thought about that. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, and this came up just the other day, a friend of mine said, you know, on the side, I have this antiques business and I want to put up a simple database. And, you know, I mean, I know that I could learn to install this or that database product and this or that templating system and this or that programming system and weave all those pieces together. But, you know, in this day and age, can't I just do that through the web? Actually pointed him at a couple of things. One was the Intuit QuickBase,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which, however, is going to be too expensive, you know, on a monthly fee basis for what he needs. But still, it's an example of the kind of thing that he needs. And the other is it's still in the pipeline, I guess, but one of these Web 2.0 companies, DabbleDB. Did you see those guys? Yes. Yeah, so isn't that a pretty interesting strategy to get people engaged with something and then to be able to gradually discover over time?
Absolutely. And so if you look at between 2003 to 2006, what has happened on the web? You've had the emergence of the blogosphere. The blogosphere has now created, at least in the consciousness of people, the concept of rapid-fire production of content, subscription and syndication of that content.
Yeah. People haven't yet, by and large, made the connection to data, but it's coming.
But at least they're looking at feeds, and they understand that feeds emanate from blogs, typically, or, you know, subscription lists and so on. And so that consciousness in the blogosphere started, in my mind, to create context for delivering something. If you have a blog system, or you have content aggregated a la, you know, Memorandum, blog lines and services like that, at some point in time, you're going to realize, as you did last year, Kingsley, can I, you know, send a query at your, you know, source of content so that I could repurpose that and do something else or have a sense of what common things we're looking at and things like that. The notion of a web database is beginning to crystallize because people are realizing, wait a minute, I have all of these feeds. In some cases, they're just blogs I subscribe to. In other cases, it's knowledge that I'm persisting through my web blog or my wiki.
Yeah, although I would have to observe that I would put you and Adam Bosworth on opposite ends of a spectrum in the sense that
somewhat.
You know, at least what Adam's been hinting at, because we haven't really seen it yet, although I guess with the Google G data stuff out now, more of the cards are on the table. But you know, his notion is very much one of simplifying the data and query models to the level of link traversal, you know, and iteration over key value sorts of data sets.
Yeah, but and I differ with the simplicity that he espouses, because you see, there's a little bit more to it than that. I am more of a believer and a proponent of the semantic web vision and the reality of the underlying data model that drives the semantic web vision. So I don't know how aware you are of Sparkle, the query language for IDF.
I was that was on the list of things to discuss with you.
So as we begin this evolution of, okay, you know, the web point of presence, you know, the blogosphere being a collection of, you know, points of presence where, you know, feeds emanate from, gradually I expect people to realize that we do need some kind of container, right, for all of this content. And we need to call this container something. So calling it a database isn't totally, well, it is a database, but what model is it? If you say, you know, it's an object relational database, you know, that's more repellent than anything else to the broader audience. What does that really mean to, you know, have a broader non-technical audience? So today I look at this container as a data space to say, well, John, can I query your data space? Or, you know, vice versa. You pop me a mail, Kingsley, could I query your data space? And I can say, well, John, no problem. I've actually made a number of things available. You're on my, you know, access control list, and go ahead. What protocol do you want to use? Do you want to use Atom? Do you want to use Sparkle? Do you want to go XQuery over HTTP? You know, the choice is yours. The content is there.
You know, as usual, the industry and people in general tend to dichotomize things. Everything has to be either or, black, white, et cetera, right? And so,
exactly.
You know, like everything else, I think that this is a continuum. And you know, there will be nodes on the network that are both bigger in terms of the amount of stuff that they contain and more powerful in terms of the kinds of complex queries that they can execute, right? So you'll have some, you know, sort of super nodes, if you will, you know, that can actually do Sparkle queries or X queries or complex SQL joins over, you know, relatively large amounts of data, right? But it's still a node in the network, right? And it still has to...
Oh, it's always these data spaces, these containers that I'm beginning to call data spaces, right? Pretty much defined the nodes on the network.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you've got a blog, you've got a data space. You may or may not know that, but you've got
That's
a data
right.
space. The question is, okay, how much of the content in that data space, right, is available for querying and repurposing?
Yes.
You
yes.
understand? Period. And I believe, just as we had in the late 80s, this sort of upsurge in, you know, relational databases and 4GL type applications within the corporation, what I anticipate, you know, in the not-too-distant future is a realization on the part of all individuals that participate on the Internet that there is a need to have a simple solution that enables you create this data space and interact with other data spaces. Now, it may be a hosted service. It may be something that you have on your desktop. The most important thing is that the data space itself, this node on the network, shouldn't limit you. So shouldn't say, well, your queries can only be Sparkle. Your queries can only be, you know, Atom protocol based. Your queries can only be open search based. You see that? That as long as there are a multitude of channels, there's the query languages and the, you know, transport protocols into that data space, then you find, you know, a significant contribution to where we are that provides real tangible value. And so if you look at Adam's view, which I see as simplistic, it still fits into that model. So if you go to my blog today, for instance, you can search in, you know, what I call the very simplest of forms. But you can begin to increase the power and complexity of your queries. So today you can go from basic free text all the way up to, say, XQuery.
Mm-hmm.
And in about, say, 2 or 3 weeks' time, you'll notice I'll simply add Sparkle to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that simply means that, you know, from your machine, you can send Sparkle, you know, because there's a Sparkle protocol in addition to a language and a result set serialization format. So not only can you sort of remotely send Sparkle to my data space, you will be able, as part of your query, to define the serialization of the result set.
Mm-hmm.
So that, the result set is palatable, right, to your system. So that you can then repurpose in the language that you choose, right, on the platform that you choose, in the environment that you choose. You know, it's all about this freedom at all of those levels. You know, the operating system, as I always say, the application level, and the data storage level.
Yeah, so then but you have to come back to the question of how do people wrap their heads around this, because, you know, the complexity or simplicity of queries on the web is exactly to the point. I mean, we know, for example, that outside of a small population of librarians who are always very interested in the most advanced query syntax, that most people type, you know, one-word queries, and that's, you know, actually crucial to the operation of the web, right? That in general, you know, the effort that is required on the consumer's part to formulate a complex query is another kind of activation threshold.
Yeah, oh, for sure. When I talk about a data space that is based on OpenLink technology, in this case, Virtuoso, right? What I haven't quite, you know, alluded to is the fact that there is a layer above Virtuoso. I may have sort of hinted to you about this sparingly over the years in sort of mails back and forth, but one of the things that we've never shown to the public is that for years, you know, we've had a file system, in a sense, it's web dev based. Now you see that with Virtuoso, but we have layers above that. such that in our particular, like Spotlight, for instance, is maybe the closest example today that I know outside of OpenLink. Although you put content into this repository, and the repository has metadata extractors.
Yep.
So it automatically extracts the metadata from known formats.
Yep.
So you put an iCal file in there, a vCard file in there, a FOV file in there, you name it. You know, we pretty much have a dictionary for all of these things. So our metadata extractors extract all of the metadata, populates, you know, our triple store, and then says to you, okay, you know what, when you come into your drive, what looks like a normal drive, when you're dealing with WebDAV, you see folders that say, well, you got people here, you got feeds, you got posts, you got calendar entries, you've got business cards, you've got business reports, XBRL, you got all of these things are presented to you in a very human-friendly form, right? And so initially, say 2 years ago, what you could do with this system internally was you could use it to determine, you know, sort of a start point for your query. But that really wasn't good enough. You know, what I really wanted to be able to do is have a very simple interface that allows the user that's, you know, interacting with this content to then formulate a query naturally without any exposure to XQuery, XPath, Sparkle, or any of those things.
Yes.
Simply say things like, you know what, can I find all emails from a certain individual that relate to a certain topic?
Yes.
Or where the content in question is tagged with the following values?
Yes.
You understand?
Well, if you've seen my latest adventure, it's exactly the kind of thing that I've been working toward. And you know, a couple of interesting things here. So this metadata explorer that I've put up at the InfoWorld site now is in a sense exactly what you just described, right? So I suck out a set of metadata values from different sources and normalize them to, you know, three or four common axes, right? And then I present a surface that is interactive, right? So if you see, you know, any tag value or any date value or any author name value, and you click on it, right, you've executed a query that constrains that dimension to that value, you know, and so there's actually no syntax, right?
But under the covers, what is your storage model?
This is quite interesting. Under the covers, at this point, because there are only something like 8,000 URLs. I mean, this is just the last couple of years of InfoWorld content, right? Articles and blogs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tractable quantity of data. And so, in fact, internally, it's a Python pickle, right?
Okay.
And so I'm doing it in memory. And this actually is quite an interesting theme as well, because, the rate at which we are adding metadata to that repository is not going to exceed the rate at which hardware and memory expand, right? So,
well, it depends on who you expose it to. Who are the metadata contributors?
I understand, but I'm saying that's exactly my point, right? At the scale at which this particular node of the network is operating, its internal production of stuff is not going to exceed its memory capacity, right? And so the question is then, how do you link this thing up with other things, right? In other words, there's no internal bottleneck. There's only a network bottleneck.
Yeah.
Which is kind of exactly back to you know, sort of Adam's point, right? Which is that in the end, there's no container large enough to contain everything.
If there was, you wouldn't need metadata, would you?
Exactly.
Right.
Well, it's still convenient, right? It still provides convenient hooks.
But you know,
there's no container large enough to contain everything. So it's ultimately always about link traversal and the costs of link traversal, right? And the friction associated with data transformation.
Link traversal, right? Is the traversal hierarchical, right, or graph-based? Are we traversing a tree or a graph? It's so important, but not obvious.
Well, it's a graph, right?
I don't know. It depends. You tell me. I mean, it depends. You know, you see, this is where the semantic web kind of gets confusing, because, you know, there's a lot of research content, you know, and some of the guys are, you know, real deep, you know, graph model geeks sort of put out a lot of content, but, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, to look at it, it's, you know, very sort of complex. you know, mathematics, and, you know, people sort of switch off without really getting to the depth of what's really going on. You know, a graph model, you know, ideally, right, will allow you to explore almost all the comprehensible dimensions, right, of the nodes in that network, you know, so you can traverse that network in a myriad of ways, and it will give you much more flexibility than if you're confined to a tree. In a sense, a subtle difference between, say, XQuery and Sparkle. I always see the difference between these two things as this, right? If you visualize nodes in a network, right, Sparkle is going to get you to the right node. XQuery may get you to the data available at that node because your journey to what you want is facilitated by Sparkle, right? And XQuery can then take you deeper into this one node, which has specific data that the graph traversal is taking you to. Do you see what I mean here?
Since I haven't studied Sparkle at all yet, if you could make that a little bit more concrete with some kind of an example, it would help.
So if you look at a typical example would be, let's take a microformat as an example.
Okay.
You know, HCard, I think there's HCalendar.
Sure.
Right? Now, because they are in well-formed formats, right, in a sense, it's XML. You can locate the HCard in question. So if you had a collection of individuals who had four files out on the network that were in a repository, typically in a triple store, right, because four, you know, could be a graph of a social network of a group of people. Now, through that graph, you could ultimately locate common interests. And eventually, you may want to set up calendars, right? But if the format of the calendar itself is well-formed, with XQuery, you want to seek a location in, sorry, XPath, maybe even, is even more specific here. You simply want to get to a node in the content, you know, in question, that is to get a value.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. So, because the content is well-formed, you now traverse within the content. But you have to get, see, XQuery doesn't help you find that content as effectively, right? Because XQuery is really fundamentally about a hierarchical model.
A much more humble version of this example. I used to work at Lotus years ago.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine had this classic story where he said, so we have this internal database. It was, you know, like the early, it was like the late 80s version of a blog, right, inside of Lotus.
Yeah.
On an early version of Notes. And he said, so we have this one Notes database that's for buying and selling stuff. And it was really cool. I put, I wanted to sell a car and I put it up there. And 2 hours later I had sold the car.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's really cool. He said, yeah, but it took me all day to figure out which database to post the listing into.
Of course. Now, but you're trying to take us, hold our thought, right? And think about what that means for just the blogosphere segment of the web, right? And then think about that in terms of, okay, the web segment of the internet, right? Because each one of these things is a collective of many nodes.
Mm-hmm.
You see that? And so again, ultimately, you know, when we look at, you know, query optimization, it's always about how do you get to the data, right? The quickest path to the relevant data. And then when you get to the data in question, is it opaque or transparent?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you go, you know, you've got to the point. Well, can you now dig deeper, you know, to actually get the actual datum, right, that your query, you know, your query is all about, that single item of data that you really wanted? And there are two challenges, getting there and then getting inside the content itself.
Yes.
You see? And so if you look at where all of this fits into what we've been trying to do with Virtuoso for years, is that in the beginning I always said, look, the values of XML are clear. It provides a great format for exchanging data, presenting data, modeling protocols. But computing is about data, right? Where is the data going to really come from? Are we now going to start reconstructing XML, right? You know, from scratch? Or are we going to try to convert as much data as we already have in, you know, those data silos, especially within the enterprise, and find a way to repurpose that content without compromising security and performance, right? Such that the content in question is now exposed as XML.
And we're, I would say we're doing a pretty good job of that so far. What do you think?
Yeah. So that was the first step. Okay. You know? But now that the content is out there, so in a sense, if you visualize those network nodes, we have the nodes and we got content, right? The next challenge is, okay, but how do you really get to the content? You see? And this is what the semantic web vision, you know, this model has always been about, but I think it sometimes gets lost in terms of the people, you know, sometimes, you know, the XML, you know, crowd who are dealing with what's in that node. You understand?
Yeah.
And the other people, the people that look at the web and its infrastructure, who are challenged by, but how do you get to the node? Sometimes there's a lot of overlap and then you get a lot of noise. And so the real message is lost in, you know, sort of misconceptions about the validity of the semantic web vision, or, you know, what is increasingly called the data web vision, you know? And like I've always said, when this thing unravels itself, right, we will, one, forget whether it was called the semantic web or the data web. You know, or even if we do remember, the names will be irrelevant.
Okay.
But we will realize a new degree of intimacy like we've never experienced before when dealing with content either behind the firewall, right, or outside of the firewall. You're going to be able to really begin to look at the reality of some very intelligent agent-style traversal of web content. And one of the things we want to try to do is simply simplify that process and collaborate with as many people as possible. So the whole open source thinking regarding Virtuoso was to say, you know what, we have this engine, right? Yes, we've put a lot of work and a lot of money into building this product, but I would rather put this out and use it to attract collaborators, you know? So if somebody really wanted to write a Sparkle application, but realized there was no triple store that implemented Sparkle completely, for instance, and so they find themselves now trying to write a database engine when all they really wanted to do was write something that would use Sparkle, why not alleviate those pains by saying, look, here is a database engine that already has this model in mind and deals with this particular data model, right? Much more than you could if you have to write a database from scratch, because a database is a major undertaking.
Yeah, so let's kind of come at this from that perspective, because how it looks to me is that in terms of open source databases, mm-hmm. Non-SQL capabilities, mm-hmm. there have been somewhat limited choices. So,
yeah.
You know, for MySQL, it's really not ever been an interest of theirs as yet. For example, to support even, you know, XPath kinds of capabilities, never mind XQuery. Okay. Postgres has made some progress in this area, I haven't looked at this in a while. I know that there were, you know, some simple XML capabilities that were available. Whether those have been woven into the core product, it's not entirely clear to me. You know, but certainly, at least as far as I know, nothing like an XQuery engine.
Are you still talking about Postgres?
Talking about Postgres now, yeah. And in both of those cases, you know, nothing like a services enablement layer wrapped around those things. Okay, I guess the third major contender here would be SleepyCat, which now has DBXML, mm-hmm. which is an XQuery engine, mm-hmm. but not a SQL hybrid. So
yeah.
just from that perspective, I would say that to have Virtuoso arrive on the scene, you know, as a full-fledged SQL XML hybrid,
Hang on.
We'll get to that, right? I mean, because I know that that's, you know, that's what you're excited about now, but let's just, you know, let's just ease into this, because just getting an open source implementation of a SQL XML hybrid, of a full-fledged SQL XML hybrid out into the wild, is a huge step in my opinion, because there just hasn't been anything like that, right?
It's a huge step, but back to what, you know, we were talking about earlier, right? Who groks that?
Well, I would say an increasing number of people, because SQL XML hybridization is now mainstream. I mean, it's becoming very familiar to SQL Server developers. It's very familiar to Oracle people, right? I mean, it's this stuff has been cooking along in the mainstream enterprise databases for years now, and is getting fairly mature, as is the notion of an embedded runtime such as Java or .NET, right? So, I mean, you know, there are a whole set of capabilities here that you've been developing, which are at the leading edge of the mainstream, right? And have not been characteristic of the open source databases that have hitherto been available, and in particular the ones that are popular.
Yeah.
So I just want to kind of stress that, right? Because I'm very interested to see where that can go. And so, you know, from that perspective, I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about the nature of the dual licensing situation, and where the money is made, what's open to collaboration, and so forth.
Okay, what's open, what's open source is the full-fledged engine I just described. So every capability you've just mentioned is available open source.
Okay.
The only thing you don't get open source is the ability to use our virtual database capability.
Right.
Whereby you take all of the functionality that you've just mentioned, right, and you use it atop heterogeneous data sources that are either ODBC, JDBC, or SOAP accessible. You see that? So you don't have this virtual database engine available in open source, but you have the pure database engine that supports, the hierarchical, there's a graph, and the relational data models.
Okay. And I have, obviously, I have connectivity through a variety of transports. And so although you say I don't have the virtual database capability through SOAP, I certainly have SOAP access out to...
Oh, you have everything. Yeah. All I'm saying is that, for the commercial edition deals with, the heart and soul of OpenLink software, which is data integration.
Yes.
Right? So the ability, because, there are a gazillion data silos out there behind firewalls in those enterprises. And it is extremely valuable to be able to provide a very simple mechanism, for getting to that nirvana called the 360 view of the customer.
Mm-hmm. So describe just briefly, if you can, what that database integration layer that is in the commercial version of the product is doing.
So what the virtual database does is, first of all, it says, select stuff from customers. Could be a customer table that's actually in Virtuoso, or could be a customer table in Oracle. Now, select star from customers, comma orders, right? Could be customer in Virtuoso, orders in Oracle. Customers in Oracle, orders in Oracle, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as simple as that query is.
And details could be coming from a web service somewhere else.
And likewise, so if I expand that SQL a little bit further, and now add columns, so rather than being a select star, select, say, column X, column Y, and then I put, column X in parentheses and call a function, my function, right, could have been a web service from somewhere.
Right.
I was going to process value X in the context of table X, table X and Y,
yes,
or customers and orders, pardon me, in Oracle and Virtuoso,
yes,
or Oracle and Sybase, or Oracle and Informix. It doesn't matter what it is. The database just needs to be accessible via ODBC or JDBC.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, so you have the results set, you realize this is what you want, you may want to persist. You may want to save that query, right, and make that query usable in some other context. So you can save that query either as a simple query file that is a resource in its own right, so it has a URI. So you can simply locate that query resource, right, through your browser and get a materialization of the result set,
right,
without any transformation.
Right.
Now with Virtuoso, you can extend that and say, before you send it to the user agent, apply this st- style sheet to the result set, so they get a nice, lovely-looking page.
Okay. Now, I'm still trying to be clear about where the line is drawn. So,
going from Virtuoso, right, out. So, you know, the backside of Virtuoso out.
Yes.
To heterogeneous data sources is the virtual database layer.
Okay.
So that channel uses ODBC, JDBC as an I/O mechanism, you know.
Right.
You know, for all intents and purposes.
But now let's say that those external sources are appearing as SOAP endpoints.
Okay.
So consumable, but you know, in a less convenient way.
Yeah.
In some sense, right?
But yeah.
but consumable now also on the open source side, right?
Yeah. Now what you have to understand is, first of all, you can with the open source version of Virtuoso, you could do a number of things. So you can go get, you know, you can interact with any web service.
Right.
Right? You can interact with a web service.
Right. No, I'm just not going to be able to join across heterogeneous tables,
basically. Yeah, that's where the virtual database comes in.
Okay. Okay.
You know, so within Virtuoso itself, you know, Virtuoso as a stored procedure language, a very powerful one of that, you know, it will allow you to interact with web services.
Right.
As you choose, so you can easily create a stored procedure and make that stored procedure part of a SQL statement, right? So if you go back to my earlier example, you can still put X, right, column X in parentheses, right? Because it's a stored procedure, and the line between a procedure and a view in Virtuoso doesn't really exist.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still apply that to your SQL statement. You just will not have Oracle,
got it,
Informix, and all of those in the from.
And that logic can be a Virtuoso PL method, but it could also be a Java or a Mono or .NET method, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And not only that, though, once it's in PL, you're just clicks away from making it a service in its own right.
Okay. So the service enablement inbound to Virtuoso is part of the
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. Yeah. So this is very cool. Where's the project going to be hosted, and you know, have you?
Well, the project's already hosted SourceForge.
SourceForge already, okay.
It's already SourceForge. There's a wiki page. So if you go virtuoso.openlinksw.com,
yes,
you'll see a link at the bottom, you know, to a wiki page as well, which is sort of tailored to the open source community.
Mm-hmm.
Just visualize a web-enabled version of Spotlight. That's the closest example, you know,
mm-hmm.
but it's a little bit more powerful than that.
That's a good phrase, though. Web-enabled virtual spotlight.
Yeah.
That's concise.
Yeah, right? So what you are going to see with a data space, you know, I tend to use the MVC development pattern to try to describe where we're headed strategically, to say, well, OpenLink as a company, you know, the model side, you know, we've been data hackers for years, so we understand data in a myriad of forms and how to deal with the challenges there, you know? We've been doing that, you know, since... I've been doing that since the late 80s. The company's been doing that since the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the layer above that. You know, that application logic layer, the controller, the middle tier, whatever you want to call it, you know? And again, you know, we're able to do a lot of things there based on, you know, the architecture of our product. Where things start to sort of level out and become a little bit more challenging for us. And if you really take a look at Virtuoso, you will see this challenge peek out at you, you know? It's a really serious challenge that we've had to deal with is the view side of this thing, you know? The viewer side, the user interface,
yeah,
you know?
Always.
It's difficult for a myriad of reasons for us. First of all, the focus has always been, you know what? If we just implement the standards, right, there will be compliant viewers. You understand that we simply bind to those protocols. We've always said we want to implement the protocols and then leave the guys that have those user interface viewer level skills, right?
But it takes more to get over the activation threshold.
The bump I hit, you know, between 2003 and 2005 was, you know what? Guess what? There aren't many compliant viewer level, user interface level products.
Right.
Because sometimes the people building those tools then dabble into the controller level and even sometimes go all the way down to the model level, you know? So they're good at the viewer, you know, not so good at the controller level, and, you know, somewhat diabolical, to be polite, at the model level, you know? And so that's the reality. So what did we start trying to do? We started trying to tackle the viewer level, and, you know, we hit some serious impedance there based on, you know, who we are and the makeup of our developers.
Mm-hmm.
It just became too difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know what? If we can focus on putting the model and the controllers out, right?
So let's break that down. What do you, in your context, mean by the model, and what do you mean by controller?
So the model right now, we've got this engine. And then we have an application layer that hasn't been released now, but it's coming out. And it's second now. So when I talk about, the old drive, or what we call the briefcase now, that is an application layer that says, you know what? You've got Virtuoso, and all you want to do is put in an iCal file, put in a full file, just grab content from wherever, start a blog, subscribe to a blog, and have one interface that simply organizes all of that content for you, and then gives you a nice, simple interface for querying all of that content without exposing you to Sparkle or XQuery or XPath.
Okay.
And if you so choose, there's always going to be a little search field somewhere, in the interface that says, okay, you can go free text, you can go XPath, XQuery, you can go Sparkle, you understand?
Yeah.
If you want.
Yeah.
You see? So I really believe that to bring coherence to this vision, and I believe the burden of coherence is on us.
Yeah, it is.
You understand? And that's what I've said to all of the developers, because, these guys have produced phenomenal work, you see? And we just have this thin level, or this thin burden of coherence, which is thin relative to the burden of trying to write user interfaces, you understand, if that is not necessarily your core competency.
Yep.
Right? In order to make your vision.
Of course, it's also not a notable core competency of most open source developers.
Exactly. So if we get the model and the controller, so that's the core database and the applications we've written around the database, even though the UIs may be questionable, we've never claimed to be that good at that.
Yeah.
But what people can do is peel back the questionable UI and see the essence of the controllers, the application logic, and the core database engine. So the worst that would happen to them is, okay, they have a good sense of how to do some of the things that we are already expressing in these applications that we release. Okay, here's how to build the file system. Maybe we like it, maybe we don't.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you know how we wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And okay, here's how you can extend it if you want. Or simply forget about that. Work with a core.
Mm-hmm.
It's just peeling back the Virtuoso onion in a sense, allowing the public to do that.
So a nice binding of this thing to Rails might be a useful thing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, strategically, the coherence, from my perspective, right, has three frontiers. One frontier is a semantic web, long term, but it is a critical frontier from our perspective. The second frontier is AJAX. I think I've hinted to you that I have something that kind of looks like Access, kind of looks like MS Query, kind of looks like Visio, implemented in AJAX and is database independent. And when I say database independent, I always mean the same thing. If the database is ODBC or JDBC accessible, we have an AJAX data access layer that will get you to those databases.
Okay, so this is sounding like...
And we've built a query builder. So what we've done is, which is a tricky thing, we've built a query builder, something that looks like Access or MS Query that allows you to visually just drag and drop, literally. Just build your query. You don't write anything by hand. And we've got pivot tables like Excel pivot tables, all done in AJAX.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not as pretty as Excel's, rendition, but they have the same functionality.
Okay. So this is sounding like the foundation of the kind of through the web development environment that I was I was hinting at earlier.
And likewise, a database designer.
Mm-hmm.
So again, a full-blown database designing tool written in AJAX. And again, we'll work with any database that is ODBC or JDBC accessible. And likewise, a form builder. So if you remember the Access form builder, one of the things that has really irked me on the web is the difficulty of building a simple form,
No kidding.
What I will do anyway for you, John, is that I'm going to put together a number of screencasts. And you're going to see how easy it is to build a form that contains a grid with scrollable result sets using what we've done in AJAX. And it's all AJAX. The behavior sort of varies between Firefox, Safari, WebKit, Opera. But for the most part, you'll pretty much see consistent behavior, drag and drop, and the simplicity of these interfaces. And that whole layer, right, is going open source.
Okay. Which means that since there are pieces of that that are already available in other Ajax toolkits, then it should be possible to do some mixing and matching.
So, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because, I mean, as you know, there's a few of these record set
Ajax kits. Prototype, Dojo.
Yeah.
And we built our, you know, this is not about NIH, but when we started this, we kind of had a kit in place, too, and said, okay, we'll put out the kit. And, again, people can always mix and match.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe the projects can even call us, you know. They come together based on, you know, okay, you do this better than us or whatnot. But the key thing for me, though, is for OpenLink to now participate. We're integrators, not just of data, you understand,
mm-hmm.
but of the vision, the big vision. This is all about collaboration and community at the end of the day. You know, it's about network and network effects. Ultimately, every company is looking to see how well they can tap the network. You know, this is going to be the challenge for individuals and enterprises. How well can you tap the network? If you're not tapping it well, you will be vulnerable. And if you are, you can have exponential, unanticipated growth in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to plug yourself into the network.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one other thing I might add, you know, I talked earlier on about the sort of three facets to the open source strategy. I mentioned, you know, the semantic web and Ajax. I didn't mention the third, and that was really about, you know, Rails. Now, right at this second, we don't have a lot to offer Rails per se, but very soon, there are two things we're doing for the Rails community. One is dealing with data access, you know, so building a Rails data provider that works consistently across any ODBC or JDBC accessible database.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, what we've done is we've come out of that driver layer, and we're taking that same expertise and applying that to writing compliant applications. You know, Virtuoso, when all is said and done, as a virtual database, is an extremely sophisticated ODBC, JDBC compliant application. So we're taking that same expertise, and we want to plant that in the Rails community. By first of all, building a Rails provider, and just simply saying to the Rails community, here is a provider that will work with Active Record and get you to any of these databases
yep.
consistently.
Yep. Yep.
Right? And deal with all of the nuances associated with, well, the DDLs differ, auto-incrementing fields differ, you know, just hide all of that away. Let the Rails developer focus on Active Record.
Yes.
Or there's another thing called Active Relation, too, that deals with... But, you know, let them deal with that because that's the layer they really want to deal with. That's where they're productive.
Mm-hmm.
The activation threshold for a Rails developer is zero at that point.
Yeah, right.
You understand?
Right.
Right? Now, there's another aspect to this whole Rails thing that isn't very obvious. Some people have sort of muttered about it, but it's the deployment, you know? The fact that you need fast CGI protocol compliance, in a sense, to really deploy scalable Rails solutions. You know that, you know, I know Apache is dealing with this sort of mod fast CGI, you know, enhancements, but historically that's been a problem.
Oh, it's always the dirty little secret of all of these things.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So one of the things that we're also doing is implementing fast CGI in Virtuoso. So what will happen about, say, 4 weeks time, there'll be another update of Virtuoso with the fast CGI support.
Mm.
Once you got fast CGI, it gets mega interesting for Rails because all of those Rails files can sit inside of Virtuoso, for instance.
Yeah.
And then you have a deploy. You know, it's kind of like bringing the Zope experience in it, and Zope in itself, you know, Python, again, has the same issue with the whole fast CGI thing anyhow.
Yes.
And likewise, we're going to take, you know, we're going from Rails to Python. PHP has pretty much worked well with ODBC. There are some subtle issues that we've had, you know, concerns about. But again, what I'm saying to you is that OpenLink software is going to actively contribute to a lot of these projects. Just plug the holes, you know. I think it's going to be easier for us to plug the holes in a lot of these projects than simply saying, you know what, here are the flaws in these projects. You understand? Come use whatever we've got.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You understand?
No, yeah. And actually, I want to come back around maybe here at the end to you mentioned Spotlight earlier, and you know, a lot of what you were just describing in terms of having this very heterogeneous data store that can hold lots of different things and have a coherent way of querying across them and managing metadata in various flavors, right? Is obviously also extremely interesting on the desktop. I mean, Spotlight is a desktop product.
Oh, yeah.
WinFS is going to be a desktop product.
Yeah.
And so Although we have tended to think of this class of technology that you've been developing as server technology, we have desktop machines that can run it perfectly capably, and seems like a pretty interesting scenario, right? I mean, in some sense.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Virtuoso, as I speak to you, runs on my desktop, right?
Yeah.
You see, I have a very federated view, right?
Yeah.
Of networking. So, you know, if you look at Web 2.0 today, what I call the precursor to, you know, whatever Nexus, Semantic Web, Data Web, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
One defining characteristic of Web 2.0 right now is that we take the view that everything is going to be hosted somewhere. So in a sense, we're looking at a centralized model, you know,
mm-hmm.
after those dumb terminals that we now call, you know, PCs with browsers, right?
Yeah.
Talking to a centralized server. We say we're networking, but you see, networking is about many points that are able to communicate using different protocols, client, server, peer-to-peer, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
So my view is that what people will really want to be able to do is, in some cases, run software on the desktop. And Virtuoso is so small in a true sense that, of course, you can run that on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you know Radio UserLand anyway yourself. Radio UserLand running on the desktop in the beginning, was one of the real keys to its success. A lot of intelligent synchronization of content, you know? There will be a day the family knows not only do they have a server machine, they have a server process. Well, they may not say a server process, but they know, look, the family machine is able to replicate those photographs out to Flickr. The ones they want to, they don't really have to go to Flickr directly to do that.
Yeah.
And by
the way, if the network connection goes down, I still have
extremely rich
access because my local server, you know, to which my let's say Rails browser-based application is communicating,
mm-hmm.
right? My local server, has a healthy chunk of my data right here. You know, I've got this thing which is this which has this range of integration capabilities, data integration capabilities, which I can, you know, place into my network at various points, and can act as an intermediary in a variety of ways that we've discussed, right?
Yeah.
But that same engine running locally with Ajax applications on my desktop or on my laptop, you know,
yeah.
that can seamlessly be redirected, you know, to nodes in the network or to the local node. I mean, this is something I've been interested in for years, right? I was doing the local HTTP server thing in the late 90s and being fascinated with the possibilities. And it's all coming back around now because, the whole next frontier for Web 2.0 and Ajax is now about persistence. And, you know, there isn't a story there. And, I hope people will see that. I hope people will reach out to this thing from both perspectives. That is to say, from the middleware perspective, but also from the desktop perspective.
Yeah, but the burden's on us. The burden's on us to put out
an application that demonstrates that.
And screencasts.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of screencasts.
It's a fascinating medium, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's occurring to me that here's WinFS, a kind of a closed technology. Here's Spotlight, a kind of a closed technology.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, maybe this is going to be the story. Maybe it could be. That would be cool.
It could be. All right, John.
All right.
Pleasure as usual.
Likewise. Thanks. Take care.
Bye.